Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of April 17th, 2016. This is Jack Brissett Mills. Conversation today with Sarah. But first, the verses I wrote for Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul. For his week three, I wrote this one 2 years ago. Verse 3. I am able, if I forget my little self, to feel my ancient self, speaking to the widths and heights about how in their great reaches I begin to feel my true depth. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse, verse 3a. A part of me knows the truth and speaks it to the cosmos when the rest of me is silent. Only outside my narrow self, in your wide expanses, can I find my true depth. Yeah, Sarah, wonderful person. Met her from a friend just over the phone. It's so nice. Thank you, people, for wanting to talk. It's so great. Anyone else volunteer, please let me know. Thanks again, Sarah. Here you go. Anyway, this isn't really an interview, but it could be if you like. Mostly it's just I'm hoping to have deep conversations with people. If they have any interest, we could make up a subject or we could ask each other what we've been thinking. What's the most important thing we've thought in the last few weeks? The idea that if you actually help each other talk about something important, you actually feel more positive, more alive than you would feel doing most any other thing. And of course, it has to be the right conversation. It has to be the right subject. You know, some subjects you get to the end pretty quickly. You run out of what to say about it. But others, they just keep going and going, and you end up talking about stuff you never really thought you would talk to anybody about.
Yeah.
Just that idea. And it's actually been quite successful. I've really loved it myself. And then the people I've talked to have been happy afterward also. So
that's really cool.
How to get to it. I had a couple ideas of how to get someone into it. One was this idea of an epitaph.
Ooh.
What would be the perfect sentence or phrase for you, for yourself, not as a humor, not necessarily funny. Like the best one I've seen on a tombstone actually said, "Well, this sucks."
Oh.
That's great. But I would rather say, no, something, what was my thesis of my life? What was my true purpose that maybe I didn't discover till I was almost at the end? Or, you know, it could be something you look back upon and see, that must have been what I was doing. Or it could be something you actually feel on the way. I think I wish I was this way.
Uh-huh.
That's a nice beginning of a conversation anyway, if you've ever thought about it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What would be your epitaph?
Yeah, for me, I've been playing with the idea of being in time. Everything is timing. Where you meet your spouse and how you avoid the accident and how you leave the room at just the right moment before something falls, you know, timing is everything. And I've had this magical feeling of being in time for long periods. And so trying to figure out, do I have anything to say about that? Is it totally random, or am I flowing correctly through life? It could be this odd feeling of purpose that when you're in time, when you feel like things are working, it could be that you are sensing that your life has meaning, that your life has purpose, even when you're not doing anything necessarily out of the ordinary, but it just feels right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've been playing with that idea. I don't know what I could say about it, except it's a wonderful idea to think that I have something to do with it. It's not just random, that I've actually correctly doing
something. I'm a real believer in nothing being random.
Good for you.
Well, and that in and of itself is kind of a random thought, but yeah, I like that idea for an epitaph because it's basically saying that the timing in which you are there in that, you know, in that grave was perfect. So it's all good. You're basically saying it's all good. It's fine. Yeah. Don't worry. Don't worry.
That's right.
It's just the right timing too, yep. Even.
I heard a guy in the war who had been shot up terribly. His buddy is holding him in his last moment, and the guy who was dying said, "Don't worry, I'm fine. I'm fine." And he meant it. He totally meant it. It's just my body, you know. It's just my body. Don't worry about it. It's very, very interesting. I love that idea that you can truly transcend the physical body, the moment. You can totally transcend life and be immortal in a certain sense, in a good sense. Not a terrible immortal like the old Greek gods or something, but.
It's so true. You don't have to feel, no matter what your beliefs are, you don't really have to feel heavy. I mean, we all do, but you don't really have to feel heavy about dying being the end because you really just don't know. You don't have the right to really worry about that because you don't know.
Yeah, nice. If you were depressed about it, that would mean you know something, and you don't.
That's exactly right.
And if you're afraid of it, that means you know something, and you don't know. It's really nice. And so you choose to believe that it is something great. Or I love napping. I love sleeping so much. And as a little child, you know, we kick and we scream, and we don't want to take our nap. And then look at it. It's the most wonderful thing. And so I think that we can learn something from sleep and death. I think we learn a great deal more from, I learn most of my wonderful things come from sleep, I think. And I can't say that won't be true after death. I'll be so much smarter, perhaps, you know.
That's so true. That's so true. That is so true. Well, and I feel like every moment, even though I don't always obey this, every moment that you think about death or fear, death or just fear, just have fear, you're not living. So you're dead in that moment. Nice. You're basically saying, I'm not going to worry about death. I'm going to be dead right now because I'm not going to be able to see anything outside my own fear. I'm not going to be able to appreciate life and be grateful and be in the moment. None of that's happening when you're fearing.
Yeah.
So it's just like a little taste of death. In the sense that you would be, you know, in the death that you're afraid of.
Have you
practiced? Because I think when we die, then it's like, you don't fear that anymore.
I want to be that way. I wonder if you have any suggestions on how, like ahead of time, before you're afraid. So you and I right now, we're not afraid, right? And so is there any way to prepare ourselves so that we won't be afraid when most people would be? That's the one question. Then the other is, if you are afraid right now, how do you not be afraid right now? So,
good question.
I mean, do you do it for yourself, or do you practice any way to not be afraid in the future, or do you have a technique that you use when you are afraid in the present?
I have techniques for performance fear, anxiety.
Yeah. Oh, I hate that.
It's like the worst. And it's so contained, you know. The performance fear is the anxiety that will come to an end eventually. It's not like I have a fear of spiders, and so you live your whole life in fear of spiders.
Yes.
You just have the anxiety until the performance is over.
Yes.
And my way of handling it, of course, is deep breathing.
Yes.
Which is, you know, paramount. Deep breathing and focusing. And trying to, I guess I'm a mind over matter person a little bit. I'm just going to try to retrain the brain to think different things.
Yep.
But thinking nothing seems to be so much more powerful if I can get into a meditative state and just empty my brain. I have about 20 to 25 voice students, and most of them are adult women, and they're afraid of sounding like an old woman when they sing, or they're afraid of singing. They've been afraid of it their whole lives. Maybe they had a mother who was like, oh, no, you're not a singer. Yes. You know, there's always some story behind it. I always tell them, if they could, when they breathe in, when they take that deep breath in before they sing, if that breath acts as a clearing out, it's almost like clearing your cookies on your on your hard drive. If you can just clear your internet searches and just clear out all those thoughts, and if a thought appears, if you're getting ready to sing and you're all of a sudden you hear your mom saying, "Oh, this is way too high for you. You're an alto." Then you stop. You stop. You write it down, and you recognize it as bull. You know, it's just bull, and it's just what one person said. And she wasn't even really a singer. She was a stay-at-home mother. What are we talking about here?
That's right.
And so I feel like that is my best way to seem to get rid of my fear.
Yeah.
I have had, I think I'm doing better now, but I've had a real fear of flying. It seems like the last 10 years. I think what happened was I got married 5 years ago, and my life got extremely better.
Yeah.
I just felt like I was part of a corporation, you know, special, something to live for.
Yes.
And I would get on that flight, whether he was there or not, and be like, okay, life just got really good, and I'm on this flight, and it better damn well not go down,
that's
you know?
Right. That's right. Where did that come from? We all have that. We all, I mean, classically speaking, I think the Jewish people have the worst of that, where you, I guess the northern Garrison Keillor's people up in Minnesota also, whenever you're feeling good, that's bad. you are much better off to feel miserable, because then everything was going to be okay. But if you're feeling good at all, anyway, that sounds just like that. Yeah, I think we have it
that's
in our bones
so
almost. Yeah.
That's so true. That is so true. That is really in it. It's just like a defeat. I think it's just, it's like this holding on too tightly thing, or when you love your life, you start to really love your life, just feeling like, oh, you know, I love it. I love it so much. I don't want it to end. Of course you don't want it to end.
Okay.
But I have really worked through that, and I've figured out ways to, and it really was as simple as occupying myself in that moment that I feel. It's when we take off and there's a little bit of turbulence, and it's right before we get to the smooth part. And that's where I have this whole scenario. It's going down, and my husband's in another seat, and I can't find him. And it's just a story I make up that grips me.
Yeah.
Boy, so that's... if I can get rid of that, then I'm good. I'm golden.
The one thing you said, Occupy, I remember in this Occupy movement, the best Occupy... Wall Street, Occupy, whatever. The best one was Occupy Your Own Mind. And that's what you're
awesome.
That's what you're talking about. And this also, this fear goes with what you said earlier, which was we think we know. And so you create a picture like, since I'm happy, it has to end. You pretend that that's the picture, that nothing good lasts for long. You know, we create a picture that we then say must be true, and darn it, it probably actually is, because whenever we create a picture like that, what I think is so amazing about the world is that people end up getting confirmation that their picture is correct.
That's right.
You know, how many people say, I knew that I was going to fail. I just knew it. And yep, sure enough, they failed just like they said they would.
Yes.
It's really quite amazing. And what you don't hear, and I would not talk about it if I was this way, if you have created for yourself a picture of the world being wonderful, you would not talk about it. You would not talk about it because it's wonderful and your world is working and you are not having to suffer for your goodness, for your good luck. You do not have to pay. That person who actually has that picture going for them, they are not going to go making stories about it and telling other people because nobody really wants to hear that. Everyone wants to be confirmed that, yeah, look out, watch out, life is terrible. And so if you can come upon a method of thinking, I can be happy and I can be happy and I can continue to be happy, if you can come on to that picture and then maintain it somehow, that this flight does not crash because I'm in love with my husband. You know, that my love is a force. You know, if you can create some picture like that and it actually continues like that and works, you would not be telling anybody about it, I don't think.
Keep it
to yourself.
I used to go to a Unitarian church. I was a section leader in the choir, and
yes,
I loved this whole teaching that they had of if you, like you were saying, if you fear something or if you talk about it a lot that this is going to happen, you're just sure this is going to happen, and a lot of times it happens.
Yes,
it's because you're stating, they think you're stating to the universe. You're just stating what that is. You're not saying the universe isn't hearing you that you don't want it to happen. It just hears that.
Yes.
And it kind of says, well, here we go. Let's make this happen. So it's like focusing on it, dwelling on it too much. And sure enough, you're right.
Yeah.
It can happen more because you're so focused on it. I love that notion for the positive and also to get rid of all those negative thoughts.
It does kind of make the world have to be a magical place, though, that's listening to us in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I almost think that if a God whispered down to us and said, by the way, didn't you notice that every time you're afraid of something, I give it to you? Haven't you noticed that? And you go, you know, I have noticed that. I knew a woman who was afraid to death. She was a new mother, and she had twins, and she was afraid of falling and getting hurt. She walked like a little old lady. She was only 30-something. She was afraid to death of falling. I tell you, nobody else would have done this. She fell through a little wooden bridge. Her legs fell through. She fell to the side, and both legs broke. And I tell you that day she was happy. We went to visit her. She was actually happy. She was relieved because she knew this was going to happen. And now she didn't have to worry about it anymore. It's exactly like she said. It came through just like she said. And I could just feel the relief around her. She was now able to go on living. It taught me a great deal about fear, that it could be that this world is a magical place, that whatever you're afraid of comes as soon as possible. It comes right as soon as it can.
That's unbelievable.
Anyway.
Oh, gosh, it's such a lesson. Oh.
I don't know that she learned it, though. I think she might have then taken the next fear as a reality as well and kept doing that.
If this happened, then... Then the next thing will happen if I'm dwelling on it. Yeah. Well, I definitely am learning from it. I'll learn from her for sure.
Yes, I did. I did my best. I wonder if the Buddha or the Christ or the whatever would say you keep coming back until you don't have fear anymore, because the only purpose to be here is to get over your fear. So anytime you're afraid, you get it, whatever it is, loss, illness. And then you come back again and you realize, by the way, I never actually die. I just keep coming back. I keep coming back. And then finally, one day I finally realize, you know, this death isn't the thing to worry about and illness isn't the thing to worry about. I guess there's nothing to worry about. Maybe that's the whole thing. I'm hoping anyway. That sounds really good to me. I've seen a lot of evidence of that. I don't know.
Well, it's just so funny that in the Bible and, of course, in other religions like Buddhism, it's there's so much talk about not fearing. And it's so funny that that is the one thing we're also obsessed and addicted to is fear.
Yes, yes.
It's just like I've known a lot of very, very evangelical Christians,
yes.
And it seems like they have the biggest sermon about not fearing, and they are the most scared people I've ever met.
Yep.
Sounds like you're holding on to the idea even more, like we were just saying.
Yeah.
Let's stop preaching about it and just try to live it.
Yeah. I do that little test whenever I'm with a group of people, like at a party, I was at last night. If you talk of, did you hear about what's coming? Did you hear about what's going to happen? When this comes about, then that means this is going to happen. People listen very deeply to those kind of conversations of how bad it's going to get.
Lord, I know.
But if you start saying, you know, I really think it's going to be okay, and I think this guy won't win the election. You know, if you start talking positively, people really look at you funny, like, why? What would you, how could you think that? You know, how could you possibly think that?
Yeah, it's definitely not popular or in to, I mean, it's almost like, I mean, my husband is, he's really good, or maybe I should say bad. He's really bad at conversation because he just will not talk about other people.
Yes.
And so all these musicians are sitting around like, oh, did you hear so-and-so at this concert?
Yeah.
I think something's wrong. And my husband will just be like, he will not respond, and they don't want to, you know, they feel bad about it. And so the conversation stops and it's awkward. And I'm thinking, wow, this should be a moment when in a conversation everybody goes, oh, good, let's not talk about anyone back,
yes.
Oh.
No,
that's a
nice
lesson to learn.
I like that standpoint. That's very nice. Hey, one thing I'm afraid of, and I think I use it to my benefit, I'm afraid of hypocrisy in myself. And so I use that for a future. For example, if I say, if there was a war, I wouldn't be afraid. I would be strong. So if I say that enough times and then there's a war and then I'm in the war, I believe that I will be stronger because I do not want to be a hypocrite.
Ooh,
and so I do
I love that. A
kind of a forward preparation. So I'm 56 now. And so I've been for years saying when I'm old and then I explain to myself how I'm going to be this very happy and open and learning and flexible person.
I love it.
And so when I get to be old, it's going to be really hard on me if I'm not, because I'm going to have to admit that I've been a hypocrite all my life. And so I think you can go forward into fear like that and work against your being afraid by telling yourself you're not going to somehow, you're going to picture it and you're going to do it the right way, and you're not going to be afraid this time. And I don't know if that would work in your concert situation, but
I love that. I think that's brilliant, and I think that I have achieved that in without remembering until you said it. I've always said by the time I'm 40, I want this, and this to be a thing that is just me. It's not even that I'm doing it; it's that I'm being this. And I have been working so hard. I'm 42. I've been working so hard for the last 2 years to incorporate these things into my life so that I really am like, I am this. And I think I've achieved it for the most part, but that's exactly right. I didn't want to be a hypocrite. It meant business, because I've been saying that. It was part of my rhetoric my whole life to be like, when I'm 40. So I love that. I love that idea.
Nice.
I don't want to be a hypocrite either.
Yeah, it is seemingly the most important thing. If you find that a politician or any leader, they say you shouldn't have sex, but then you catch them having sex, you know, that's the worst thing. Not the having sex, but the fact that they were against sex. That's much, much worse. And so this being a hypocrite is really very powerful. And so I've mentioned the samurai practice of imagining their own death every morning. That's like a ritual every morning. They imagine being killed every possible way they can think of it. In a way, it's a preparation for actually being in a dangerous situation. But it's also a freeing of yourself. You have died then. Every morning you die, and then you can go out into the world, and you can be stronger than anyone you meet because everyone else is afraid of dying, but you've already died.
Oh, wow.
I love that idea. So somehow we can turn that into, I've had the same anxiety. If I'm in a group, in an audience, and questions are going to come at the end, and I have a question, boy, my heart will start going boom, 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 boom. And I love to try to make that happen before I'm in the room. I like to imagine, how do I make my heart do that? Because it's me doing it. I'd like to figure out how I do that, because that's very cool to be able to make your heart go fast like that.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's so true. You could rule out, you know, if your heart gets your heart beating that fast, you could maybe even rule out cardiovascular, running on a treadmill.
That's right. But somehow we do it when we're sitting in the room, everything's quiet, and all we have to do is think, I'm going to ask a question. Boom, my God, the heart just races. And so that's very interesting. I want to figure that out.
Yes.
And so I look into the future like that. I'll try to sit myself in the situation before I get there, so I can live into the fear that's going to come into the future and try to eliminate it before I get there.
I love that. That's a great idea.
But it's rough.
That's probably what happens when singers practice. I think there is always a moment when I'm practicing where I go, oh my God, I don't know this piece. This is hard. Ah!
Yes.
And I usually find it's better by the next practice.
Yeah.
But maybe that's that forward preparation.
Yeah.
That's cool.
When I was in high school, I did these solo and ensemble, it was called. It were these festivals.
Oh, yeah.
And I played a euphonium. I played a brass instrument. And I was the best in my school, and so we'd go off to these events to test ourselves against other schools. And there was one solo I was playing. I was standing in the room playing for the judge in this little room, and darn it, I left my body. I was actually watching myself play the solo. I was watching myself, and I was playing, and I was admiring my playing until I realized who's playing? Because I'm out here looking at myself playing. I wonder who's actually playing. And then I lost where I was in the music. And so then I found myself back in my body again. But that was very weird. That was very weird. And I think that...
Oh, my gosh, it's crazy. I love it.
I think that opened me up to the possibility of thinking that there's more than the material world. If you can do that kind of thing, you know, like people say after death or near-death experience, if you have your own evidence of that, that makes everything a little different the rest of your life.
Oh, true. So incredibly true. That is crazy. And I bet I've had similar experiences as a singer because you, you just get so weird.
Yeah, you're afraid. You're totally afraid. Completely afraid.
Yes. Yeah, it's crazy. It's really crazy. That's amazing. Do you still perform?
Like this, I perform and I do write. I try to be naked. I don't know if you've noticed it. It's really a freeing thing. You see these people who take all their clothes off and walk down the street. I can understand that. I can totally understand that. Because when I write, I just write the deepest thing I can possibly write. It's actually very freeing to not have to worry anymore about what people think about you because you've said everything you can possibly say. But
that's incredible.
But it's the same kind of thing, I think. So performing, you're totally naked when you're performing. Everybody sees everything. They're even seeing inside your mouth when you're a singer. It's really quite amazing.
That's so true. They see it all. It's so true. It bothers me sometimes.
Do you ever sing backwards, like some people wouldn't want you? Like, they're in the back of the room, right? They're singing from behind. That way,
yes,
you're not bothered by the physical body of the singer.
Yes, I have sung in a lot of church cathedrals, and there's always an organ loft. And
yeah, that's right. The Catholic services, they're often up above and nobody can see them. Yeah.
That's right. And it's a totally different thing. Funny how the posture, I have a little problem where my posture changes when I sing enough so that my feet hurt really badly after I'm finished.
Wow.
I'm still trying to figure out what the heck I'm doing. But when I'm up there, I do not have any foot issues.
Oh, yeah.
So it's almost like I'm posturing in front of these people.
Yeah.
And when I'm not, I'm much better.
I found that very same thing as teaching. If I would teach a class, math and science mainly, if I have taught a class and I come home, my legs hurt and it's like I've been climbing a mountain. And I don't think it has to do with effort or posture. I think it is that the head and the trunk suck away all the energy that normally would go to your legs and your arms to just think on your feet. You have to be so on your toes in a certain sense that I think that's where the pain comes, is that you used every bit of your body's energy to do what you were doing, and then your feet have suffered, your legs have suffered.
So true.
I bet it's not a posture issue, actually. I think it's that you...
Wow, that's amazing.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think that is so true. I think that's a real possibility, because I've been a singer for a really long time, and the fact that that is a thing, like, come on, I've been working on my posture for 20 years and I'm still struggling. So that's a really good thought.
I mean, otherwise you'd have to film yourself and look at it and say, what was I doing? What was I doing? I was jumping up and down. I didn't realize.
I'm standing on my tiptoes.
Yeah.
Oh,
it sounds like you're kind of operatic in a certain sense. If it,
yes.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I've loved trying to do that. The I don't know who wrote it. For the first Bach prelude, the prelude in C, which is very simple. Everyone knows the first piano piece that Bach wrote in his Well-Tempered Clavier. Anyway, somebody wrote an Ave Maria for that.
That's right. It is.
Ave Maria. Like that one.
That's right.
And I love trying to sing that loudly, like a person would sing it.
That's awesome.
But it's really hard. The people I've heard that are really good at what you do, they are so incredibly loud. They're just amazingly loud. You don't understand how that comes out of them. I don't know. I cannot do
it's
it.
So true.
I'm pretty loud, but I'm nowhere near as loud as like the mariachi singers and the operatic singers. They can be so loud.
The mariachi singers just surprise me every time. It's just like they don't have any technique from a classical standpoint usually, and they can wail. I'm the same way. You know, I'm an opera singer, but I still, when I hear a really big voice or a voice, period, I'm just always blown away. Like, how is this possible? How are we doing this?
Yeah.
How do I do it? I can't really hear it when I do it because the body kind of shuts down. You can't hear everything you do. But when you hear someone else, it's just like, how is this possible?
The Broadway singers as well, of course. They're having to project, usually not having amplification. They have to project against a lot of people in the audience, yeah.
That's exactly right. Well, this has been a really nice conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Very nice. Very nice. Thanks again, Sarah. And thank you for listening. Try again next week if you would. And leave me a note if you like at reasoningwithanoptimist.net. This is Jack Brissett-Mills. Bye-bye.